There's Always a Side Door by Anna Girl. The fandom Stargate Atlantis, the ratings G. It's genfic, featuring Evan Lorne and Vala Maldoran. Tags for Alternate Universe, Canon Divergence, Amnesia, set after the Ori War. Sometimes, Evan almost thinks he remembers a time before the city. He'll let the strange, vaguely unsettling idea sit with him for a few minutes, or even a quiet hour. Eventually, he'll shake the thought out of his head, telling himself there's nothing to it. It's obviously nonsense, because the city is always and forever. Until the idea comes back again. And again. Evan isn't at Cheyenne Mountain the day the Atlantis expedition departs. Technically, he could stick around and help everyone gear up. He could watch his personnel, some that he knows, but most who he's never seen before, file through the Stargate, and he could help shove crates and boxes behind them. It's tempting in some ways to volunteer for all that. But a long overdue 72-hour leave is even more tempting, so he takes those 72 hours, breathing air that isn't recirculated and that isn't on an off-world planet. He sleeps and he kicks back with pizza and a couple of beers, and he thinks about almost nothing at all. When he returns, the SGC is still abuzz about the departure. "Success?" he asks Sergeant Harriman in passing. Harriman nods. "Dr. Ware radioed before the gate shut down. Everything looked good. The city was intact, and it seemed to be reacting to them, with systems coming online. She said they'd send updates as soon as they could, and she sent us some preliminary location confirmations." He's mildly surprised by that last part. No one had expected they'd be able to keep the Stargate open long enough for anything beyond getting as many personnel and supplies through as possible. Evan briefly wonders if they'd tasked someone with trying to get confirmation about galactic location quickly, though he can't imagine what the technical details of that would possibly be. And that's probably the last time that Evan actively thinks about the Atlantis expedition, beyond idle hope, for years. Not that anyone would blame him. Other things come to the top of the list. Fast. Atlantis, General O'Neill says to Evan as he walks into O'Neill's office. Maybe he's walking with a limp, and he's still got a cane in his right hand, but he's walking. And there are a lot of people who won't ever be walking, or breathing, again. So Evan will take hours of rehab, and the painkillers, and the limp. He'll take it all, and he'll be thankful for it. He's lucky, and he knows it. He waits until O'Neill nods at the empty chair next to the desk, before sitting down gratefully. He's pretty sure the relief doesn't show as he sits. He's had a bit of time to practice. Atlantis? O'Neill's face is drawn, and his shirt is a little loose around the shoulders. He looks like someone who's lost more than he thought he could. It's a common look these days. Evan sees it in the mirror more often than he'd like. "It's time we found the expedition," O'Neill clarifies. "If they're still alive," he doesn't have to say. Evan nods. He can see the logic in it. The Ori are gone, defeated. It was hard won and brutal. He wouldn't say the SGC is a shell of what it once was, but it's limping along, as much as Evan is. As much as the planet is, frankly. And a good part of the galaxy, for that matter. Stargate Command has always wanted answers about what happened to the Atlantis expedition, and there's finally time to find them. And they all need a project that isn't about laying low and rebuilding, that isn't about what damage the Ori inflicted, how bad it was, and how much worse it could have been. They need options and the possibility of renewal. They need the hope of finding old friends and lost personnel. They need something. So Evan says yes when O'Neill asks him to head up the new expedition to search out Atlantis. They don't have a ZPM to spare on dialing the gate. Everyone knows that. But they do have the Daedalus. Thank you, sir, he adds, because General O'Neill is watching him with an odd expression on his face, like he'd expected Evan to object, or hesitate, or ask, why him? Evan doesn't have objections, or any real hesitations, and he can guess why him. There was a time when the brass would have suggested Evan take a prolonged medical leave, or might have fielded the idea of a medical discharge. But these days they can't afford to discharge experienced officers, especially those with reasonably strong ATA expressions. And they can't risk Evan walking away either. General O'Neill says, after a short silence, we'll send Marines and a couple of science personnel. Got any preferences? He asks, sliding over a thin folder that Evan knows will contain names. That list of names will be thin compared to 2 years ago, but he takes it because it'll still be the best of the best. The best of the remaining best. I'll submit a list by tomorrow morning, he says, and I'd like Vala, if she's interested. The general raises one eyebrow, but he nods. You ask her, though. They'd kept the Daedalus as a reserve ship, hidden and waiting. It was more symbolic than anything, but knowing it was out there had been comforting when everything seemed to be falling apart. It had been a last-minute evacuation ship, a source of emergency supplies, a final reserve to help them go down while committing as much damage to the RE forces as possible. It had been a reminder of what the SGC could be when it wasn't being attacked by almost insurmountable enemies. It's beautiful, Vala says, when the ship comes out of hyperdrive in the sky above them. They can't actually see the ship, of course, but they see the flash of light and they know what's up there. Yeah. Evan keeps his face tilted towards the sky, now an unbroken blue again. Of course, Colonel, she says slowly, like she's testing Evan's new rank out. I'm sure it will be as drab and functional as you Tauri always make things. Honestly, I'm not sure I'll survive 3 weeks on a ship like that. Let's hope there's adequate entertainment. 18 days, Evan reminds her, assuming the coordinates they have for Atlantis, extrapolated from the information Dr. Weir sent through years ago, are correct. Assuming the city is still there. On some planets, 18 days is 3 weeks. Evan looks away from the sky and takes in Vala's profile. There are new streaks of grey in her shoulder-length hair, and she's frowning faintly, even as she teases him. Fair enough, ma'am, he says dryly after a minute, and watches as the corner of her mouth twitches upwards, just slightly. He's not sure if they're friends, precisely. He's seen what she can do, and how hard she fights. He's seen her be simultaneously relentless and flippant in the field. He's watched her pick herself up from the loss of friends and teammates, and from the weird shit that went down with her daughter. He knows she used the gold healing device on him when he was unconscious and nothing but a mess of broken bones, blood and viscera. Dr. Lamb had said she'd worked on him for hours, taking breaks for just a handful of minutes before starting again. He knows he owes her his life, and that he's not the only one. And though she's never said anything, he knows she feels the weight of all the ones she couldn't save. Better get packing, he tells her, turning to look back towards the entrance of the mountain. We leave in 96 hours. I've been packed for days, she replies, her tone light, but not light at all. Yeah, he knows the feeling. Oh, treasure, of course, Vala says, every time the Daedalus crew members ask her why she signed up for the mission. Can you imagine it? Ancient treasures unknown. The possibilities are endless, and I do find myself without adequate treasure these days. She'll kick her feet up on a chair, or lean forward against a console, and wax poetic about the glories of treasure, patently ignoring the incredulous or unimpressed looks on the crew's faces. Of course, she says more than once, I only agreed because Colonel Lorne is leading this mission. He owes me quite a bit, and I choose to take that in the promise of treasure. The crew don't know what to make of her. They largely sat out the worst of the war with the Ori, though of course they'd heard about her before things got really bad and there was no longer any time for gossip. But they've never seen her fight. They don't know her. Sometimes the crew look to Evan for something while she talks. Reassurance, maybe, or resignation, as though they think he's settled with her. He doesn't give them anything except a blank stare until they look away. Evan figures if this is what she wants them to see, an acquisitive alien with no loyalties to Earth, he'll let it be. For now. As long as it doesn't cause any real problems among the crew or with Colonel Caldwell, the ship's captain. Every time she's flippant and mouthy, and every time she pushes the crew's buttons or asks someone if they've experienced the exquisite feeling of gold sliding through their fingers, he wonders how often she thinks about what Atlantis could have meant to the war. Could it have brought advanced weapons to the fight? Could it have functioned as a safe haven for evacuees? Could it have been a source of hope and respite? Would it have meant fewer losses? Evan tries not to think about those questions too much, even on the worst days, when he wakes up and there are shooting pains from his back to his ankle, when he's stiffer than he should be, and when the physical therapist, one of the medical personnel he'd picked for the mission, pushes him almost too far. Those days are fewer and further between, and he's barely touched the cane since he came aboard. But they're still there. If he had to bet, he'd bet good money, or good rations, that Vala thinks about what Atlantis could have done for them more often than she'd like. The journey is uneventful, although it feels like he's holding his breath through it. But it's quiet in hyperspace, and it stays quiet when they drop back into normal space, just outside of the system where they're fairly sure Atlantis is located. They sit on the edge of the system, taking readings and observing before they cautiously approach the only habitable planet. From above, it almost looks like Earth. There are blue oceans and green-brown landmasses. It has an orbit of 26 hours, and it looks calm. On the view screen, the city comes into view. The image is small and the details are indistinct, but it's definitely a city floating on the ocean, far from the coast. It looks peaceful. Something inside him yearns for that. A day of it, a handful of days, a month, forever. What do you think? Vala asks him in Caldwell, when the city doesn't respond to hails on any of the standard frequencies. I think someone is down there, Evan answers. There are all kinds of reasons they might not be responding, all kinds of good, sensible, cautious reasons. We should take precautions, Caldwell says, in the tone of a man who's tired of the precautionary approach and who sat on the sidelines for far too long. The city has multiple piers jutting out into the ocean. Scans show they're more than large enough for the ship and that they're composed of material that can take the Daedalus's weight. One already has a ship on it, a small blur that seems alien, and yet, somehow, to Evan's eyes, familiar. They make the decision to approach. The landing is painless and smooth, and they're guided by what Evan assumes is an automated message directing them to the northernmost pier. It should feel like a trap. Logically, he knows he should be alert and almost jittery. There should be sharp, rapid discussion on the bridge about whether this is a good idea or a shockingly bad one. They should be going in weapons hot. Instead, Evan stands, hands behind his back, the ache in his leg almost forgotten as the bridge is silent except for confirmations of approach, descent, and landing. He's fairly certain, as they settle onto the pier, that this is the first time the Daedalus crew have actually landed on a planet. Something about the way Caldwell congratulates them confirms it. They beam off the ship. It's just easier. He's blinking in the sunlight, taking in as much of the impossibly beautiful city as he can when they spot people approaching in the distance. "Welcome, party incoming," Vala murmurs, tensing slightly beside him. "Weapons stay down," he says to the three marines at their backs. He trusts that Caldwell, still on the ship, will retreat if necessary, and that he'll leave them behind if he has to. It takes a moment for the people to resolve into anything beyond obviously human shapes, but when they do, he feels a burst of joy, relief and recognition. The small group is led by Dr. Weir and Major Shepherd, people Evan has never personally met, but who he recognises from the dossiers he'd memorised on the journey here. They look good, healthy. They look like they belong out here, surrounded by a shining, alien city, bathed in sunshine and the ocean air. Momentarily, Evan wonders what they see when they look at them, if they see how worn along the edges he is, and how Vala's bright smile is more than a little brittle. But for all their apparent well-being, something's off, too. Everyone on the welcome party is wearing clothing nothing like the Atlantis expedition uniforms. Instead, they're dressed in a mix of pale woven fabrics and drab leather. Shepherd and the men behind him, obviously marines from their bearing, although their hair is far from regulation, have a mix of strange and familiar guns at their sides. When Evan looks closely, some of them are wearing standard-issue SGC boots. He glances at Vala and sees that she's frowning, just slightly. "They've been stranded out here," he says quietly. "Probably had to make do with what they could find." "Perhaps," she replies, although she doesn't sound entirely convinced. And then there's no more time to speculate, because Weir and Shepherd have stopped a handful of paces away and they're waiting. Evan takes a deep breath and he smiles. The expression feels vaguely unfamiliar on his face. "Dr. Weir, Major Shepherd, it's good to see you. I'm Colonel Evan Lorne. General O'Neill sends his compliments on behalf of Stargate Command. We're sorry it took us so long to get here. We've come with supplies and updates." "And questions," he doesn't add. "Lots of questions." He expects sighs of relief and cautious smiles and questions about what happened. He expects marines who loosen up just a bit as they grin, and inquiries about family members, and curiosity about the Daedalus. He expects anything except for puzzled expressions and the wary exchange of glances between Weir and Shepherd. He doesn't expect the silence, awkward, and long enough that Vala shifts restlessly beside him. Finally, Dr. Weir speaks, her tone pleasant and mildly curious. "Welcome to Atlantis, Colonel Lorne. Forgive me for asking, but would you mind explaining what Stargate Command is? I'm afraid I can't recall meeting your people before." The city is just as magnificent inside as it is outside. It's gleaming metal and glass, highlighted by wood accents and glossy, well-tended plants. The light from the high windows is strangely filtered and clear, like it's the refined ideal of light. Perfect and uplifting. It makes Evan long for something he can't quite put a name to. His hand curls reflexively around an imaginary brush until he shakes it out, at the same time as he mentally sets the sense of longing aside. As they walk, Dr. Weir is talking about the city and how many people inhabit it. "Of course," she says a bit ruefully, "we have more space than we need, but there's room to grow." "How long have you lived here?" he asks, carefully offhand. Dr. Weir stops and looks at him, her expression oddly blank. Then she smiles graciously, as though he's asked a rude but forgivable question. "Oh, I can't imagine ever having lived anywhere else." "Ah," he replies, exchanging glances with Vala. "You must feel very lucky." "I do. We all do, of course." She turns away from him and is striding forward before he can ask any more questions. From what he can gather, "we" is most of the expedition, and, he suspects, others who have somehow found the city. Shepherd and the Marines walk behind them, a loose group. Evan thinks he recognises one of those Marines, Aidan Ford. They'd met a handful of times at the SGC, Ford young and enthusiastic, always eager to walk through the Stargate, a slight bounce in his step. He looks different now, older, but his smile is just as bright as Evan remembers it. Dr. Weir's talking again, sharing inconsequential details about the city, pointing out things of interest. Evan half listens, trusting that Vala is taking it all in. Eventually there's a pause as their small group, minus the Marines, enters what Dr. Weir calls a transporter. When the door opens, they're somewhere else. The city is busier here, people moving through the hallways and between rooms, chatting with each other and nodding at Dr. Weir and Shepard. "I think I know someone who might live here," Evan says. "Colonel Sumner? I heard he was here." Behind him, Shepard coughs, a startled sound. "Marshall." The way she says his first name speaks of loss. "I'm sorry to say that he's no longer with us. A stray Wraith patrol ambushed his trade team some time ago. He didn't make it." "Ah," Evan says again, wondering who the Wraith are. "He's missed," she continues. "How did you say you knew him?" Evan is saved from answering by Vala interjecting and asking Dr. Weir to explain how the transporter works. And then they're entering a room filled with chairs and a glossy, expensive table. "Please, Colonel Lorne, Ms. Maldoran." Dr. Weir gestures at chairs that could almost be from one of the expensive furniture design places Evan had sometimes seen in the gentrified parts of San Francisco. He sits, grateful for the way the chair curves to support him, diminishing the lingering ache in his leg. Dr. Weir looks like she knows exactly what he's thinking. Dr. Weir offers them quarters in the city. "Temporary, of course," she says with a smile. "I imagine your ship, though it looks quite fine, has rather cramped living conditions." "It does," Evan replies without really meaning to. "They always do." She laughs lightly. "You'd think we'd learn, really, and yet every single ship I've ever had the pleasure of touring has had small cramped quarters." "Have you been on many ships, then?" Vala asks, leaning forward against the table. "More than enough, though I much prefer the city." "I can see why," Vala replies. "It's lovely. A treasure." Dr. Weir beams at her, a proud parent and a content citizen. "It truly is." They accept the offer of quarters for anyone who wants them, though Evan hedges on how many people are on the Daedalus. The city probably has sensors that tell them something, but it doesn't hurt to keep specifics close to his chest. "If you don't mind," he eventually says, "we just need to confer with our people on the ship." He hasn't said much to them so far, except to General Allgood when he'd notified Caldwell that they'd be entering the city. "Of course," Dr. Weir says, and she and Shepard leave the room. "We shouldn't stay," Vala says, as soon as they're alone. "Yeah, on some level he knows that. But there are all kinds of reasons they might not remember us. Some kind of sickness. Something about the city, something they ate. Who knows? It's worth trying to figure it out. We owe it to them." The thing is, it's clear they remember the broad strokes of who they are. Dr. Weir knows she's a leader. They can all speak English. Shepard and the Marines are clearly comfortable with the Earth weapons, even if they might not know where they came from. They're soldiers, obviously. And they all know how to be people. They know the right social cues. There's nothing off about their body language or their facial expressions. It's disquieting, but it doesn't scream danger to Evan. He says as much. "Have you considered," Vala replies slowly, "that our ability to discern danger has become skewed towards the overt ways of war?" "Maybe, but he'd think, if anything, his sense of danger would be heightened these days. And right now, mostly what he feels is calm." They contact Caldwell and relay the situation. "It's weird," Evan finishes up. "It's a decidedly unprofessional way of putting it, but it sums everything up well. There's a pause before Caldwell says, "We owe it to them to try and figure out what's going on," unknowingly echoing Evan. So they agree that the new expedition members and a handful of the crew can enter the city. He's confident that with the scientists, medical staff and the technicians scanning the city from the Daedalus, they'll be able to figure it out. Shepard delegates Ford to arrange escorts to guest quarters for the expedition and crew members, but he takes Evan and Vala himself. Shepard seems wary, but generally friendly, and he moves around the city like it was made for him. "You a pilot?" he asks Evan as they walk down a brightly lit hallway. There's something in his tone that makes Evan grin. Shepard might not remember where he's from or where he learned to fly, but pilot still recognises pilot. "I was, once, for a while. Good guess." "Once you've settled in, I'll show you our ships. We can take one out for a spin tomorrow, if you want." Evan snorts. "Your tech is pretty advanced and different from ours. I might need a bit more time to figure it out." Shepard shakes his head, happily smug. "Believe me, you won't." Then they're at the quarters, two rooms next to each other, and down the hall from where everyone else will be lodged. They've been assigned an entire floor, a few floors above Central City quarters. They check out Vala's room, bright and open, comfortable and just strange enough to remind Evan that they're far, far from Earth. He waits until she nods and says she'll see him after they freshen up. Outside his own quarters, Evan thanks Shepard and then looks him up and down. As casually as he can, he says, "Those boots look pretty comfortable, sturdy." And they do. They're worn in but not worn down, right at the sweet spot that Evan knows all too well. He'd pored over the list of supplies that had accompanied the original expedition, so he also knows exactly how many extra pairs of boots have been sent through the gate. He figures Shepard could be up to his third pair by now. "Where'd you get them?" he asks as a follow-up. Shepard looks down, frowning slightly. When he looks back at Evan, it's with the same blank expression as Dr. Weir's when Evan had asked her how long she'd been in the city. Then the expression clears and Shepard half grins, sliding his hands into his pockets. "Why? You looking to do some trade?" "Nah," Evan says easily. "Hey, thanks again for the escort." "No problem," Shepard says, rocking forward on his feet. "See you at the welcome dinner." The welcome dinner is a mix of lively and relaxed, and it's so busy it seems like it's attended by most of the city's inhabitants. Evan feels genuinely welcomed, if baffled by the polite questions about where they're from and what their planet is like. Caldwell, off the ship for the meal even though he'd declined to take quarters in the city, looks vaguely puzzled. He'd known Dr. Weir years ago. "Not as friends," he told Evan and Vala on the journey here, "but we worked together. She was a good person, driven, curious, a leader and a diplomat." Caldwell mingles and engages in his stiff, slightly awkward version of small talk until he nods at Evan across the room in silent confirmation that it's Dr. Weir, as he remembers her. Evan circulates before the meal is announced, chatting with his people and with the lost expedition members, especially those he remembers. "This is almost creepy," Vala murmurs when they move to sit at long tables laden with unfamiliar dishes and fruit. "Yeah," Evan says, smiling attentively as Dr. Weir stands to toast to new friends. "We welcome all of you to the city of Atlantis," Dr. Weir says, her voice clear and warm. "May we be a part of each other's lives for many years to come." Beside him, Vala raises her glass in thanks, and Evan follows suit. They all do. As he swallows a mouthful of the light, sweet, faintly fizzy wine, Evan decides that creepy isn't the right word. There's no sense of underlying dread here. Yes, the memory loss is odd and fundamentally wrong. It's a puzzle, and a curious one. But these are their people, alive and healthy. They're content in a way that's almost intoxicating. And this is the city that Earth had hoped for, shining and beautiful, a beacon of the future, drawn from the past. It feels like it could be a home. There's something about that feeling that should bother him, but surprisingly, it doesn't bother him at all. Sometimes Evan almost thinks he remembers the time before the city, but the thought is a ridiculous one, even though it comes to him from time to time. The city is always and forever, and nothing else matters. "You didn't show up for our breakfast date. Are you in one of your moods again?" Vala asks as she enters his quarters. Glancing at the sketchbook in his hands and the smudges of charcoal in his fingers, she sighs. "How long have you been sitting there? You need some fresh air." She loops her arm around his and pulls him away from his desk and towards the balcony. The door slides open as they approach, the way every door in the city easily slides open for Evan. They don't always work quite as well for Vala, and there's something wrong about that, something that nags briefly at the corner of his mind before it's gone again. The salt air is cool against his face as they lean against the edge of the balcony, taking in the city's vista and the ocean beyond. "You do get stuck in your own head sometimes," she says, grinning at him. "I'll never understand it." She's right, but sometimes there are just things that don't sit right. Sometimes he wakes in the mornings from half-remembered dreams of a planet covered in cities that look nothing like Atlantis, and spaces that are dull and dark, full of tense, anxious people. Or he'll wake up with the memory of faces that belong to no one in the city. Or a feeling like his leg should ache and that he should be limping, just a little bit, even though his leg is whole and uninjured and always has been. On those mornings, it's like a dark, quiet side door is opened in his mind, revealing unsettling things. This morning he'd woken from dreams of oval ships, hollow and glowing at the centre, set against a backdrop of dark skies. There'd been a sense of dread overlying those ships, although they're nothing like anything he's ever seen. It's not the first time he's dreamt about them. The dreams leave him with unanswerable questions. Drawing them, and painting them when he has the time, helps. Faces, places, ships, things that don't exist and never did. Of course, he mostly paints the city's vistas or the off-world communities and people they're allied with. Right now, he's working on a series of small, colourful depictions of lively markets, each square piece neatly set on a shelf as it's finished. He already has takers for pieces in the series, though some will be small gifts as part of reaffirming diplomatic relations with key planets. As interesting as it is to visit those planets, Evan can't imagine living anywhere but Atlantis. Looking out at the spires, beautiful and elegant, familiar but somehow otherworldly, he says as much. Vala leans against his side, her long hair tickling his neck. Where else is there to be? They stand on the balcony for a while. Breathing the fresh air does clear his head, enough that he starts to realise how hungry he is. He really should eat something. Stephen and the Daedalus crew are expected to return this morning from a 5-day meeting with the gathered traveller fleet, and Evan anticipates he, John and Elizabeth will have a long day of updates and briefings. "Let's go eat," Vala says eventually. "I've got a busy day of trying to convince those strapping Satidans that their guns are sexy, yes, but they're not quite as valuable as they think they are." Evan snorts. "They are as valuable as they think they are, though good relations with the Satidans themselves are more valuable. They can track like no one else, even to the deepest lairs of the remaining wraith hives. And while the wraith aren't looming threats, their numbers kept down thanks to strategic actions among relentless allies, Evan will breathe easier, they all will, when the hives are finally eliminated." She laughs and turns away from the city view. "I suppose we can all be glad Elizabeth didn't assign you to hammering out terms with them then." Then she's leading him away from the balcony, chatting about breakfast, that it's a wonder to see how much the Satidans can eat in one sitting, and how lucky they are to have a steady trade relationship with the Genii, because otherwise the Satedan delegation would eat them out of house and home. He lets her steer him around his easel and past his desk, where his sketchbook is still open to his unfinished drawing of the improbable, dreadful ship. But the gloom from his lingering dreams has dissipated, leaving him focused and calm. It's going to be a good day. He can feel it. The end.